This is FinTech Takes, the podcast keeping you in the loop on all the latest FinTech trends, news, and ideas. I'm Alex Johnson, creator of the FinTech Takes newsletter, your host and self-confessed FinTech nerd. Let's go! Help attract more borrowers and build a more resistant loan portfolio. Payment Guard Insurance from TrueStage is a first-of-its-kind insurance solution designed for digital lenders to do just that. Visit www.truestage.com/payment-guard to learn more and talk with a member of the TrueStage team. Hello, and welcome back to the FinTech Takes podcast. My name is Alex Johnson, and I am absolutely delighted to bring you a very special episode today. As folks who know what I'm up to right now in the newsletter and the podcast might be able to glean, I've been diving in deep into like fintech history and trying to read as many books about sort of the origins of the industry that we all work in. And there's one book in particular that I really enjoyed the first time I read it, and I just got a chance to reread it recently. The book is called The Founders: The Story of PayPal and the Entrepreneurs Who Shaped Silicon Valley. And I am absolutely delighted to be joined by the author of this great book, Jimmy Soni. Jimmy, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, Alex, thank you for having me. I think I caught a reference to the book on your bookshelf, and I was like, well, in the age of the internet, I can just thank Alex for this. That's really nice of him to put me on there.
Oh, my gosh. No, I was so happy to get your message because I had this ambition to have some folks who had written these books and been close to the subject matter come on the podcast. And I mean, first, I'm fascinated just by the process of writing a book like this. I know it was a bit of an odyssey for you. So I'd love to get a little bit of the story of why you decided to write it and kind of what that process looked like. But more so, I mean, I think we were talking about this before we started recording. This isn't that long ago. And yet when I read this, it blew my mind in so many different ways in terms of the characters who were involved in this, people who like everyone listening to this podcast are going to know. They're like titans of Silicon Valley. A lot of them are still like deeply enmeshed in fintech and financial services. And a lot of the like technology and the ideas that were being kicked around, you know, 30 years ago that are strikingly relevant and exactly the things that we're still talking about today. So would love to dive into that. We promised not to spoil the whole book because people should be reading it themselves. I could not recommend it more highly. But Jimmy, just to start, I mean, the book is incredible. And I think a large part of that beyond the amazing writing and reporting that you did is this like constellation of talent around PayPal that you wrote about. So can you sort of walk us through, when did you become aware that like PayPal was one of these sort of groups of genius that sort of coalesce occasionally in history? And why did you decide to write the book?
Well, first of all, I just really appreciate the kind words and you championing the book. I mean, this is like, you know, as an author, I didn't set out to like look for a financial services story to tell, right? That's not my process. So it's nice. What's nice is that people who are highly knowledgeable about the field and who also can take kind of this much wider view, the fact that you appreciate it actually means a lot to me because I am not an expert. And I was coming in, I mean, honestly, like this will sort of hopefully be interesting to your listeners, but I was like Googling basic terminology, right? I mean, I'm trying to make sense of it.
Yeah.
But in a way, what was valuable about that is that a general audience could then find, like, they'd go through the same process of discovery that I did, right? So, like, here's an example, just to make it concrete. Like, we say the word viral or virality.
Yes.
But it's around this period of the internet when virality, quote unquote, is becoming a thing for the first time. So what I had to do was, like, go back and, like, wait, where did this come from, this idea?
Yeah.
And I kind of did the research of figuring out, okay, well, there was this case study where Hotmail, quote unquote, went viral because they included a little sign-up link at the very end of their email. And the only reason I learned that is because I'm sitting in interviews and I'm asking, you know, these sort of people who are there, wait, when did you first discover this idea that like user growth could come through something like virality? Like, where does that come from? And they're like, well, you know, we all got like Hotmail accounts and it was because of this little thing. And then it was a gentleman named Luke Nosek who said, you know, they actually wrote this case study up in a newsletter that was circulated at the University of Illinois. And I saw that and it embedded in my head like, huh, the best products encourage the users to find new users, right? And so like organic growth through this kind of virality is something that can be very, very powerful because Hotmail grew so rapidly. In any case, it's just a way of saying like, I was not an expert in fintech, nor was I an expert in like technological or tech reporting per se. I'm not writing about Musk every day. I'm not writing about Levchin every day. I was a bit of an interloper. I fell into this story. But the quick version of how I got to it is that I had spent several years writing the biography of Dr. Claude Shannon, who may not be super well known to your listeners, but he was the founder of a field called information theory, and he was one of the leading lights at Bell Laboratories. So Bell Labs is probably a name that most people have heard. And in the 20th century, there is arguably no greater collection of talent. They, you know, this is a group that wins multiple Nobel Prizes. They invent the transistor. They invent touch-tone dialing. Like yep. we use something created at Bell Labs every day. And so I just, what I did was like, when I was like procrastinating on writing that book, I would just look around and I would sort of think like, you know, these stories of these groups are really interesting. Like, how do they come to be? Like, why is it that like these little clusters of talent exist, and how do people find their way there? And so naturally, you sort of think about like Xerox PARC is one cluster. You look at Fairchild Semiconductor within tech history, that's another cluster. You know, there are others in culture and art. And then you kind of look at the 1990s, there's no density of talent that rivals the folks who are at PayPal, right? And it's not even because of the people that you know. Like, yeah, you know Elon Musk, you know Peter Thiel, but, you know, the founders of YouTube were early PayPal employees. The founders of Yelp were early PayPal employees. Yammer, Palantir, SpaceX, Tesla, LinkedIn. Many of, I would say, like the, like in many cases, I was meeting employees who were either like somewhere between employee one and employee 25 at many of these companies that are still around today. And so what I did is I actually just went on Amazon to try to, like, I've assumed that someone had done the book.
Sure, sure.
Like,
I actually, yeah, yeah.
Like, because it's just like, it was just such a crazy cluster of talent. These people are rich and famous. Like, I figured somebody had written a version of this story.
Yeah.
And there wasn't anything out there that really captured kind of like, how did this company come to be? And how did all these people find their way to this company? And that was, it was just something that like basically bothered me. I was like, wait a minute. This is a consequential company. The company is still around today. Both for the impact of its alumni and because of what PayPal did within fintech.
Yeah.
This is like a super important company. Like, how come no one's done this book? And then you kind of come up against a natural question, which is it's super hard to get all of these people to sit down and talk to you. And just both because of their just general skepticism of people who write things.
Right, right, right.
And then also because they're just, they are still building. And so
right.
It's not as though this is like their last hurrah. And now they go back and they reflect on it. It's like these people are all actively building things. So that's basically where it started. It started with the question and the puzzle of why hasn't this book been written? And then I kind of just, you know, I went for it. And it was a matter of many, many years of outreach and research.
That's amazing. Well, it really is stunningly well reported in terms of just the number of interviews you got. I mean, you sat down with all of the notable folks that you just mentioned, but also a lot of folks that I think, yeah, people don't know, or that played these pivotal roles. I mean, you mentioned Luke before. He was one of my favorite characters in the book because, you know, I think there was at one point they were talking about, like, what's his role at the company going to be? And like, he's just going to have Luke ideas and sort of wander around and think smart things and come up with, like, customer acquisition hacks that then become part of the playbook of how you grow tech companies in Silicon Valley. So it really is just this amazing constellation of talent, as you mentioned. And I'm glad that you got obsessed and sort of mad about this not existing, because now it does.
Yeah.
It's awesome. So I want to go through a couple of the sort of early years. We promised not to spoil the whole book, but I think that one of the things that's really interesting that you set up really well at the beginning of the book is there are these different groups of people who are kind of on this slow moving collision course. And we sort of know that it ends up with PayPal, the company that we all know, but it's a pretty interesting story. And all of these sort of random collisions of these incandescently talented people. So I wanted to start with Max Levchin and Peter Thiel. Can you sort of walk me through? I mean, obviously, I think everyone listening to this podcast certainly knows who both those folks are. I think maybe outside of fintech, Max Levchin is a little less well known, although Peter Thiel has a pretty high profile these days. But where did their paths kind of first cross? And what was the initial vision they had for their company, which was originally called FieldLink and then Confinity after that?
It's a great question. And it's actually interesting because I'm talking to someone in you, as well as your listeners, who actually know who Max Levchin is.
We do.
Which is great.
We do, yeah.
Right? He's today the CEO and founder of a firm He's one of the better regarded, engineers in Silicon Valley, CEOs yep. in Silicon Valley. And it's interesting because outside of Silicon Valley, Max is not super well known.
No.
Right. And so you have this interesting cognitive dissonance because the people that I interviewed who had worked with Max and even kind of in and around the ecosystem speak of him like really glowingly. I mean, like to a person, right? Even Elon, who battled with Max a little bit during this story, spoke of him really in a praiseworthy way. And at the same time, like I had this curious character who has this incredible life story, but had never really like, he's not a household name. And by the way, I actually think he prefers it. If I had to guess, I've never asked him this, so I think he prefers it that way.
I'm sure you're right.
I think he's an engineer's engineer. He's somebody who likes solving problems. And his view of startups is this is vehicle to solve for problems and frustrations that he sees in the world, right? A more lucrative life choice than writing books. Let's just say.
Yeah, right? newsletters too. Newsletters too. Yeah.
My problem fixing yields books. His problem fixing yields multi-billion-dollar companies, right? So in any case, you asked the question, how did he and Peter Thiel intersect? So they intersect in 1998, and it is sort of total happenstance in some ways. Max has just moved to the Valley after graduating from the University of Illinois, and the internet boom is happening. He's moved west to kind of figure out how he's going to participate in the internet boom. He'd built some what he would regard as sort of failed companies, or several failed, one sold for a small amount of money while he was at the University of Illinois. He moves out west. And he's in an apartment that doesn't have air conditioning. And I guess it was like a particularly hot summer in Palo Alto.
Yep.
So his hack for that is that he'll walk around Stanford's campus and basically just kind of see what classes he could kind of anonymously drop into, right, without anybody getting noticed, so that he could have air conditioning for a little while.
That's hilarious.
Right? And he sees a flyer, like a post, some kind of posting for a class taught by this guy named Peter Thiel. And the class is on like global markets and currency trading or something. And he had heard Peter's name before through Max's U of I friend, Luke Nosek. So he's like, well, you know what? Worst case scenario, like I'll get some air conditioning. Best case, I'll like go meet this guy. So he goes to this classroom fully expecting it to be packed. And it's only a handful of people. And Peter gives this lecture. And Max's immediate reaction is, this guy is really smart. And that doesn't sound like much, except that Max is very, very, very smart, right? Sort of near photographic memory, truly like true brilliance, right? In a way that I often, especially for the writer about him, can be eerie because he'll remember stuff.
Sure.
And he'll remember it down to the detail. He sees Peter and he's like, if I'm ever going to do anything financial, I ought to talk to this guy. He goes up and basically introduces himself and says, hey, I'm friends with Luke Nosek, and Peter basically asks him, what are you doing now? And he goes, well, Max says, I'm going to build a company. And Peter is looking at investment opportunities in the Valley and says, great, we should meet. Like, how about breakfast? That is what begins, at this point, a multi-decade long friendship and partnership that commenced with breakfast at Hobie's. And so they meet at Hobie's for breakfast, and Max pitches him on the ideas that would become PayPal.
That's amazing. So on those ideas, I found the pivots really interesting, right? Because I mean, this is very typical in startups, but you have this idea, if an investor asks you, what are you working on? What do you want to do? And it's like this. And you kind of see them like not respond to it. You're like, okay, well, how about this? And then they kind of respond to that. And then, you try that or you try a little thing around it and it doesn't really work. And then you're like, well, maybe we pivot to this. And so reading about the history of Max's sort of evolution of the idea that eventually became PayPal is fascinating, partially because some of the things that he was working on, and even the things that like he discarded, are things that he was way too early to, but are things that are now like a huge source of focus and investment in Silicon Valley today, right? Like it seemed like one of his earliest ideas was basically on-device encryption and security for mobile computing. So for, IT workers who were going and logging into different buildings and had to carry these like fobs in order to generate codes to get into buildings, well, he was just like, well, we have Palm Pilots. It was Palm Pilots at the time, right? So like, can we just do that encryption on the device and then people don't have to carry these things around? Encryption on a mobile device, like that's exactly what we're all working on right now. It's the forerunner of what eventually became a lot of the stuff in crypto and Web3, which I know he's been sort of involved in, or at least at the periphery. And going through so many different evolutions of, yeah, okay, this is a Palm Pilot. We can use it for mobile security. Maybe mobile security is not the thing to do. Maybe we're a little too early there. How about mobile wallets? A concept that we talk about all the time in fintech. Well, no, people aren't quite ready to like ditch their physical wallet for a mobile wallet. Most people don't have Palm Pilots. Okay. How about like password management? Can we do password management? Maybe, maybe not. There was this brief concept of like a mobile IOU or like kind of a digital check, like if I owe you money. And then finally landing on the sort of last idea that I think they kind of glommed onto that isn't exactly PayPal, is kind of the early version of PayPal, which relates to Beaming. Can you explain that one?
Yeah, that it's so clear to me that you carefully read the book. And I really appreciate it because you captured almost, I think, every one of the consequential pivots in the early company's history. And just to give readers some context, when the company starts, it's called FieldLink.
Yep.
And the idea is that like Max had done some work on mobile device encryption, kind of saw that mobile devices were going to be the future. But unfortunately, at the time, they weren't really the present. That evolves in the series of steps you just described to a concept that was about beaming money. So here's the rough gist of it. You have these devices, these Palm Pilots, and at one iteration of the Palm Pilot introduced an infrared port. So they had an infrared port in the corner, and it could be used for two Palm Pilots communicating to one another. The funny thing about this is that when Palm did it, they didn't really even have like a use case that they could describe, right? Yep. Like it was sort of there, maybe it could be used for something. And the thing about infrared is it's not like Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. It's very weak and it's very glitchy. And so you kind of like have the possibility of gaming or something.
Yep.
And Max and Peter alight on this idea, like what if you could use it to beam money, right? What if we were sitting in a restaurant in Palo Alto and I owed you $5 and I didn't have cash with me and I could just whip out my Palm Pilot and I could give you $5. And then when we sync the devices, this is the hitch, when we sync the devices back on our desktop,
yeah,
the money would transfer.
Yeah.
And so this is an idea that captivates the team. They think, okay, we've got this nifty new technology, infrared built into the Palm Pilot, and we've got a use case, which is, well, let's like beam each other money. That'll be amazing. It's the future, right? And so their view, and I think they're heavily influenced by the excitement around like all things technology, you know, the latest device or feature is, okay, this is going to be it. Like we're going to beam money to each other and that's totally what's going to happen.
Yeah.
In the process of building that beaming product, it is actually so hard to reconcile the transactions that Max builds effectively a backup system. And the backup system is a way of testing the plumbing of the entire system. And that backup system is the backbone of it is email. So the idea is like, he needs to make sure that money's going from point A to point B. Well, it's like kind of cumbersome to do that with Palm Pilots. You've got to like upgrade things and whatever. It's like, all right, well, we'll have our backup system be email. And like, that's another mechanism that people can use. But you know, woe betide, God forbid somebody would use email as opposed to the Palm Pilot, which is the device that they're all obsessed with. And so it's in the course of figuring out how to do Palm Pilot beaming that they effectively create email beaming. Like they're going to have email money transfer as a part of their product offering. And it is another person who enters the story at around this time, David Sachs, who is a friend of Peter's from Stanford. And Peter tries to pitch him on joining this Palm Pilot money beaming company. Then David, sort of in sort of typical fashion, is like, that's a really stupid idea. Like the ceiling on that is really low.
Right.
Like you got to like, how many people have Palm Pilots? All questions you ask, like how many people have Palm Pilots? Like how can this work? He says, but if you are planning on making emailing money your primary use case, like I'm in. Like I think you should kill off the Palm Pilot thing and just do email money because that could be a truly breakthrough product. And that is basically in summer and fall 1999. That is when the company, they have both products active, by the way, and they have the Palm Pilot product active for a really long time.
Yeah.
But that is when the product comes to life as the emailing money product that honestly we all still know and love and use.
I really got a chuckle out of the visual you painted of David Sachs in the early days. And he was, I think, the chief operating officer, right? That was his role.
He became the chief operating officer. He comes in as what's known as like the chief strategy officer.
Oh, okay.
Which even he admitted, he's like, it's a title that was sort of like meant nothing. Like I had come out of McKinsey. So maybe Peter thought it was like strategy was my thing.
Yeah.
But what he became was effectively the company's chief product officer. The title that he would have today would be chief product officer.
And it was interesting because I think he described like his role was just no, right? Like that's stupid. We're not going to do that. We need to focus on this. And it was so interesting reading that because there was still sort of the engineering part of the team And I think Max was kind of like the head of that and the face of that, that was like, but the Palm Pilot, you know, right. And it's like, like, you're the only ones who care about that. There's a great anecdote in the book about, I think it was when they were doing their first like public test of the beaming and they were trying to get ready for it. And I think they were actually, weren't they doing the transfer of the initial venture capital that they raised?
Yes, that's exactly right.
From Nokia. And they got it all set up. And of course, it's like your typical like demo where like it's chaos behind the scenes. They're like, oh no, it's going to work great. And they get it to work and they beam the money from one device to the other. And they see the thing go through. And then the camera crews from the television stations that are there are like, oh, we missed that. Can you do it again? And like, Max Lipton like has a heart attack. He's like, no, we can't do it again. Do you know what we just did? So there's some really cool anecdotes about just like the evolution of that product. And then this sort of backdoor into email, which you put in good context in the book around like, this is when email is ascendant, right? Like mobile technology is a ways away, but we have, you've got mail with Tom Hanks. We have just the use of email as a mechanism for communication exploding. Like people don't get a lot of things about the internet or mobile at that time. But email, it has its mass market moment. And so it turns out that that's kind of this tide that lifts everything up. And I want to circle back to that. But before we do, the other obviously massive personality in all of this that enters the story is Elon Musk. And I had no idea until I read your book that one of Elon Musk's first jobs was as an intern at Scotiabank. As someone who works in financial services, that like blew my mind. I was just like, oh my God, I literally can't believe that. But I'd like for you to just walk us through quickly, why did he go to work at Scotiabank? What was he doing there? And how did that experience like shape his view of banking?
No, it's a great question. And honestly, no one, you know, we have a hard time, I think, even in our minds, like imagining Elon the intern,
totally.
Right? Elon the bank intern.
Yeah, boss. He has a boss. Like, yeah, when was the last time he had a boss? Yeah, it's wild.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, this may have been the first and last time he ever did. But there's this period in his life, you know, he leaves South Africa and goes to Canada. And when he arrives in Canada, both he and his brother end up in Canada. And one of their techniques, and by the way, this is like, it was actually a really useful thing to learn because it demystifies some of the, you know, some of like, these days Elon is a Rorschach test.
Yeah.
He's less of a person. It's more like you say the word Elon and you'll reveal more about the person's response,
right?
Than you will about Elon himself. But I think one of the interesting things about him is that he really does have somewhat modest beginnings. And this is one example of the modesty, which is he and his brother arrive in Canada. They don't know anybody. They're at university. They're trying to figure out, like, what do we do? So they take interesting people they find in the newspaper and they will cold call and just try to get meetings. And so I think at one point I had read somewhere, I didn't ask him this specific question. So this is not something I fact checked, but that they had like reached out to like somebody at the Toronto Blue Jays.
Wow.
Right. But one of the people they reach out to, they had read about this guy, Peter Nicholson, who was involved in Canadian politics. They found him really interesting because he was a scientist who became involved in politics. And he had transitioned out of politics to working at Scotiabank. And so they basically like called this guy and said, you know, Dr. Nicholson, like, we'd love to meet you. And I found Dr. Nicholson and he said, he's like, well, yeah, he's like, you don't get a call every day from like two people who are just like interested to meet you, right? It's like rare for somebody in my position to just get a cold call. And so he said, okay, I'll meet you for lunch. They get together. And, you know, they're very dynamic. They're dynamic then, dynamic now, both Kimball and Elon. And essentially, they're asking or soliciting for like an internship. And Dr. Nicholson says, look, I don't have two spots on my team, but I have one. You know, one of you can come aboard. And that is how this starts. So Elon takes the internship and he ends up working at Scotiabank alongside Dr. Nicholson. And the value of this role, in addition to the relationship that he develops with someone who would basically become a mentor, I think it'd be safe to call him a mentor, is that Dr. Nicholson is basically like a kind of consulting outfit within Scotiabank reporting directly to the CEO. So Elon is not having to do like basic banking tasks. It's just that this CEO, his name is Cedric Ritchie, he will assign interesting questions to Dr. Nicholson. And then Dr. Nicholson will go back to this small team that he has and say, let's figure out the answer to this question, right? And it can be big macroeconomic stuff. It can be internal stuff. But that's Elon's exposure and introduction to banking and financial services. And it's a very unique vantage point. Also, remember, he's like, you know, not even 20 years old at this point.
Right.
And so he's getting all of this kind of exposure very early. But that is what starts Elon's interest in financial services. And I would add one final thought. It specifically starts his frustration with banks and with big banks and their inability to think in more dynamic ways about their own business.
Yeah, I mean, you have a great anecdote in the book about a specific problem that Dr. Nichols is given and puts Elon on, kind of to like, I think you described it as like, give sort of his hyperkinetic intern something to do and chase, which is a great way of describing, I think, Elon Musk then and certainly now. And you can just sort of picture him like diving into this problem. But he comes up with sort of an innovative solution, proposes it to Dr. Nichols, who then sort of takes up the chain, and it gets denied. They don't do it, largely because of kind of just your typical bank kind of conservative risk management type reasons. And it's so interesting reading that story because you can just sort of picture Elon Musk like cementing this idea in his head that like banks are hopeless. Like banks are just hopeless. And like they're so massively big and important, and yet there's no chance that banks will ever be able to keep up with technology and to just sort of evolve their business model. And I'm sure there's many, many different thoughts and motivations that drive Elon Musk, but everything that he's done since then seems sort of rooted in that, like, I can't believe that they wouldn't do this. Like, I just can't believe it. And so I want you to fast forward a little bit. He comes away from that experience and founds a company called X or X.com, right? And I have another question for you later on about the name X, and I just want to get into naming generally for a second. But before we do that, can you sort of just explain quickly like what his goal was in building X, and over, you know, the next couple of years as he's working on it, like how much progress does he make towards this vision? Because I mean, he's obviously world famous for huge ambitious visions and then pulling reality closer to those visions. And this financial services one is no exception to that.
No, that's exactly right. And you know, the details I can add, he basically has this idea that there should be one centralized place for all things financial in someone's life. So, and there's an insight that underlies that, which is in the age of digital information transfer, when we can move things around using bits, why is banking still so expensive in the form of fees and costs and delays, right? So the idea is really simply, like he says, if money today, meaning at that time in, let's say, 1998, 1999, if so much of money transfer is not moving like gold bars or moving physical bills from place to place, then why is it that, for example, like I pay a fee for like a wire transfer, or I pay a fee for this? He says, because what you're doing is you're moving like bits from one database to bits in another database, but that is not very expensive relative to what banks are making on a transaction like that. And so his basic thesis is like, what if we could just have it all in one place? All your money, your mortgage, your brokerage, your loans, your insurance, your basic checking, savings, credit cards, debit cards, everything. And he sets out to bring that vision to life. And it's an enormous vision. He even positions himself in the press. He says, we're going to be, you know, cheaper than Vanguard. We're going to defeat, you know, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, all of these people, because we're just going to take all the money, because we're just going to be a lower cost provider for all services. And it's in the course of creating that, that one of the features that X creates is an email money transfer mechanism. So what they do is they basically say, well, naturally, if like you're a member or if you're a user of X, if you're a customer of ours, you should be able to email money. So I should be able to send Alex $5 using email. That's a natural byproduct of basically wanting to do everything financial. It's not the big breakthrough use case, right? But what he finds in his early presentations to people and in the early success that the company has is that the feature that people are most excited about is the email money thing. They think it's like incredible in the same way that the folks down the street, Peter and Max, are saying, wow, people are really wowed by this email money thing, right? And so that's basically the very short, very compressed history of X. I'll add one final thought on this, which is he gets further than most people think. Like today, you know PayPal as like the emailing money company.
Yep.
When Elon was building it in the summer of 1999, they had X branded debit cards.
Yep.
You know, he manages to actually take the vision pretty far. Like he has checkbooks made. And to this day, he's frustrated that PayPal doesn't have physical checks. It was one of the more colorful quotes in the book is I was interviewing him about this and he got on the topic of checks and he goes, he's like, sweet baby Jesus, give him goddamn checks. Like referring to contemporary PayPal. That was one of the funnier lines. It became like a little tagline among friends of mine and I, which was like, sweet baby Jesus, give him goddamn checks, right? He wants all things financial to have less friction, to have less cost, and to be warehoused in one place, which for him is X.com.
That's amazing. And I'm so glad you mentioned the progress that he made, because that was something I didn't realize, right? Like, I was paying attention to different things at that time and things of a much less consequential nature. And so I didn't really know what was going on with X. And it was a relatively short period of time, but it is really interesting. And you do a great job describing this in the book of, I almost think of it as like Elon Musk that we know today, which is like smash through any barrier, any type of regulatory thing that gets thrown in front of him, even if it's relating to like sending rockets into space. He's like, no, that's stupid. We're going to do it anyway. Like, he's honed this methodology of building great things and smashing through any obstacle. So picture that, but like early days where he's still probably sort of like developing that superpower, combined with financial services, which is unusually conservative and highly regulated, even among the fields that Elon Musk has since jumped into and tackled. And it's so interesting to kind of watch those two like opposing forces play out in your book in that summer of 99, because like, yeah, they had a debit card, they had a bank partner, they were sending out checks. I think they were actually doing like lines of credit. But at the same time, they were also getting in trouble with regulators. And there was like, I think a New York Times story about some security vulnerability.
Yep.
And like, there were all of these things that were your typical Elon Musk move fast and break things and don't slow down and don't like listen to anybody. But watching that contrasted with financial services, I mean, seriously, anyone who works in fintech today and is like sort of amused or frustrated by fintech running up against regulation, whatever, like take the worst version of that and the most intense version of that you can imagine and magnify it by 1,000. And that was like X in the summer of 99. So I'm glad you mentioned that. But honing in on this email money concept, it's fascinating, first of all, that all of the principal folks involved in it, apart from, I guess, David Sachs, were like, this is stupid. This isn't what we're trying to build. Like, what are we doing here? But everybody loves it. And so like the market just converges on it and finds perfect product market fit. And you do a good job painting the picture in your book of X.com and Confinity. They were actually like close from a geographic proximity perspective, right? Like they were sometimes in the same building or within like the same general area in Silicon Valley. But while they knew about each other, they didn't really care or like the view them as competitors until this email money thing started. And in particular, and you do a great job of framing this in the book, the war for eBay. And it like, it sounds like it's just a thing that happens over like almost over a couple of weeks, but there becomes this frantic war over eBay. So can you sort of explain what that was?
So, you know, take a step back. We're looking at like the summer of 1999. This is the year before the dot-com bubble bursts.
Yep.
There is still a lot of heady optimism within Silicon Valley about all, you know, about everything, about how the internet is going to literally just transform everything. And you have these two companies with two different casts of characters. You have X.com, which is trying to be like the bank Uber Alles, like the one place everything financial can go. And you have this company that has more called conservative ambitions, which is we're going to make digital money transfer through email and / Palm Pilot work for users. And what happens, and this is one of those things that like, I think it's hopefully it resonates with readers, listeners who might be at startups where you kind of fall into product market fit. You can't engineer these things precisely. This is something that happened to both of these groups of people. And I say that because you look at these people now and they are kind of a who's who of Silicon Valley.
Totally.
And even they had the accident of the following success, which is both services take off on eBay. And so at the time, eBay is already a publicly traded company. They basically built the world's first successful digital auction marketplace. They are massive, but what they haven't done is figure out payments. And that in some ways was a deliberate strategic choice, because if you quote unquote figure out payments, you've then got to deal with the regulations and the burdens and all of that. So they let their users, buyers and sellers, just figure out payments on your own. If I buy, like if I buy an old baseball card from Alex, fabulous. You've used eBay. Good luck. Like just go figure out the payments yourself.
Right,
so I could send Alex a check. I could send you a money order. What into that vortex steps Confinity with this product they have called PayPal, and X.com with its emailing money product. And what that allows you and I to do is now I've bought your baseball card. Well, great. I can just send you money using PayPal. So like, here's your $50. Now send me the baseball card. And it is cheaper and easier than money orders, Western Union, checks, cash. And maybe we're using cash. They were sending envelopes of cash to each other to reconcile eBay transactions.
Crazy.
And so you have like these two companies, and then they do one other thing that leads to the wildfire growth, which is they give money away. So
viral growth. Like, yeah, virality.
Viral growth. And so what they do is they essentially incentivize, like if I open a new PayPal account and it comes through Alex's referral link, you get $10, I get $10, and then you get another $10 if I like open it and use it, right?
Right.
And so the idea is like that enables crazy growth on eBay because it changes the margins on eBay auctions. So a lot of these eBay auctions at the time, they're not high. Like we know eBay is the place where you can buy a car and buy like true luxury items. At the time, a lot of what's being sold on there are like small time items, you know, Beanie Babies, yeah, like things you'd find at a flea market. So if you're getting like potentially $20 on a transaction, like your margins are like increasing considerably in some cases.
Totally.
The other thing that eBay has is a concentrated community of sellers and buyers that are all on these message boards where they're like rapidly absorbing information about eBay. So at some point, multiple people start saying, hey, have you guys checked out this thing, PayPal? Geez, these guys give you money and you're allowed to send money. This is so great. And from there, the growth was mathematically viral, like truly true viral growth. And so they ran the numbers that basically you have two primary players, Confinity with its PayPal product and X.com, and they start a multi-week war with each other. And the way Elon kind of archly and somewhat humorously described it is that it was a race to see who could run out of money the fastest, right? Which is a perfect way of putting it, because that's basically what happens is as soon as something like that takes off, you have scam artists, you have fraudsters, but you also just have like a massive increase in the amount of money that is going out the door,
right,
because you're giving away these bonuses.
And that's a great way to put it, because the other piece of context to all of this is the sudden competitive stance between Confinity and X.com. They're doing the same thing. They ended up in the same place, kind of randomly fell backwards into it, which is just an amazing coincidence. But the other part of it is they're not necessarily at equal footing, right? Elon Musk at that point was pretty well known, right? He had sold an earlier company. He'd had a good exit. I think he bought a really fancy sports car. So he was pretty well known and kind of intimidating. He was able to raise money. I think he raised, was it Sequoia that he raised money from?
From Sequoia.
For X.com. They had very, very deep pockets, whereas Confinity, a little bit different, right? Because even though a lot more folks know Max Levchin and Peter Thiel now, they weren't quite in the same position then. And they had raised money from Nokia, which is not quite on the same level of a Sequoia. And right, the picture you paint here is that there's this point where they're engaged in this battle to see who could run out of money first. And it seemed as though, particularly for Confinity, there was going to be a problem relative to X.com just because they weren't quite fighting on equal footing. Then enters into the story someone who I know because he does feature into financial services history pretty prominently, but I think a lot of people don't associate with PayPal, perhaps partially because his tenure there was very, very short. But can you introduce Bill Harris as a character and what role he played?
TrueStage Payment Guard Insurance is a first-of-its-kind insurance solution built for digital lenders, designed to help you attract more borrowers, strengthen your loan portfolio, and reduce time spent on collections, all with minimal tech lift needed to go live. To learn more about Payment Guard Insurance, visit truestage.com/payment-guard and speak with a member of the TrueStage team.
He's a little discussed figure in this story, and it took me a long time to kind of track him down and to get him to open up about this. But, you know, because of what you described, Elon is more established within the technology firmament at this time. He's had a successful exit. When he launches X.com, he recognizes that he can leverage that and bring in a high-profile CEO. And the high-profile CEO he brings in is Bill Harris, who's at the time when he's recruiting him, the CEO of Intuit. And so he brings him in, and it's a huge thing for the company. I mean, this is like Intuit's a well-known, well-regarded brand. They're consumer-facing. Elon's a coup. He's gotten Bill Harris. Oh my God, this is crazy. And let's just say, you know, it's like hard when the egos in this story, it was actually Bill who said, you know, there are so many egos in this story, not one of us could like fit in a stadium, right? And so there's this, basically this clash that happens between these two companies, but also a clash that happens at the top of X.com, where Bill and Elon have a disagreement. Bill's contention is that the fight with Confinity is ruinously expensive, that it is going to tank both companies, and that the markets, this is now early 2000, are starting to sour on all things technology. Like, the environment's going to be different. And Elon says, no, we're going to beat them. Like, we're going to hack and slash on account growth. We got them. We're going to. And essentially what Bill says to Elon is, he says, look, at this point, also another piece of context is the companies now, they know about each other.
Right, right.
And they start discussing a merger because they have the two biggest user bases for emailing money on eBay. And they're both noticing, like, this is a massive amount of red ink to be spilling. And so they start discussing a merger. Elon is opposed to it. And Bill says, we merge or I quit. And it was kind of this ultimatum. It was a hard thing to do in some ways, but in some ways he was saying, look, I can't persuade Elon. The move I have to make is I quit. And the reason that this is a threat is because they're raising a round of financing. And Elon says, look, if you quit, like, we could lose fundraising, and this is not going to get, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And so he essentially strong arms he's one person who strong arms the merger, and the negotiators on the Confinity side push for a 50-50 merger, which is not what Elon wanted.
Right, right.
So you have all these parties who basically, like, get unhappily married in March of 2000.
With Bill Harris, like, holding everyone's hands and, like, pulling them into the aisle, right.
There are other figures here who had to do somewhat of the same thing. Peter recognizes that the competition is not good for either company.
Yep.
They kind of come around to the realization that it was the right move. But at the time, now I describe it in the book as a shotgun wedding, and it really was. This was a merger done against Elon's will because Elon believed that he had the resources and the staying power to outlast Confinity, and that they would essentially, like, run out of money, but he wasn't going to. And by the way, mathematically, he was probably right.
Yeah.
Like, they probably would have run out of money before he did.
Yep.
And it's possible they wouldn't have been able to raise a subsequent round of financing. In any case, that is where you're left in March in 2000, which is, you know, you have these two companies merging, and it's happened in the course of what, 8 to 10 weeks total, is like they first realize they exist and then they decide to merge. And you have people at the top who are deeply unhappy about this. One person who's had to issue Elon an ultimatum in order to get it done, right? Like, there's all of these complexities, and that's where you find yourself in March 2000, and that's exactly when the NASDAQ starts a slide that would wipe out, you know, 86% of the value of the NASDAQ at one point disappears in the year 2000. And they sort of talk about, like, dog years. Like, you have to measure the four-year history of this company, because it's only 4 years of the period that I'm writing about it, is to really be measured in dog years. We are really talking about a classic startup story, 7 days a week, intense pressure. You know, and it was pressure, by the way, not just internally, the fact that these are all big personalities, but also, like David Sachs described to me, he said, you know, it is really something to be walking the streets of Palo Alto and see windows boarded up because startups have gone kaput.
Totally.
And he said, that's, like, really scary when you're at a startup and you're bleeding money and you don't know what the future's going to hold. So that's kind of the context for listeners who might be familiar with the PayPal story. It is far more precarious than it seems.
Yeah, precarious and, like, condensed. It's amazing. So you end up with this merge company that eventually, through a subsequent number of things that you cover really well in the book, becomes the PayPal we know today. There's an IPO, there's an acquisition, there's subsequently a spin out from that acquisition. I won't spoil any of the remainder of the book, but suffice it to say, if you haven't already been intrigued enough to pick up this book, really, it is an absolutely incredible history of those 4 years. Before I let you go, do you mind if I just ping you on a couple of the sort of more amusing anecdotes from the book? Because there were a couple that I got a good chuckle out of. One is, immediately after what you just described, right, the two companies have merged. They raise a $100 million round from investors as well, right after they merge. So they have this war chest of money. They've merged together. They've stopped this sort of ruinous competition. And it's just in time because, as you said, the NASDAQ crashes to the ground. Huge amount of value gets wiped out. There's sort of this existential sort of failure happening in the valley everywhere around them. And Peter Thiel, who is quite a colorful character at a number of different levels, there's a great little anecdote that you had tossed in that I'd never heard before, which is that after they raised the $100 million, he had an idea that he wanted to pursue. And so he convinced Elon to let him go to the board and pitch this idea, which is, give me the $100 million, because he has an investment company that he invests in the market. Give me the $100 million and I will short the public markets. Because I don't think that we're anywhere near the bottom of this dot-com crash. That blew my mind when I read that. And I just want you to, like, quickly characterize, like, it sounds like the board looked at him like he lost his mind. Like, what was the reaction to that idea?
And it was fun. One of the nice things about this book, like a listener could plausibly ask the question, like, well, why wouldn't I just watch one interview with Peter or one interview with Elon about this period? And it is because the fun for an author and hopefully the fun for a reader is that I get to do the like asking each person the same question test, right? Right. And so I got to speak to the board members who were on the receiving end of Peter's proposal.
Yeah.
I got to speak to Peter about the proposal.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to speak to Elon about the proposal. And I got to speak to Max about the proposal. And so it's this really funny thing of listening to their reactions, right? But I think one of the things that characterizes, in my understanding after doing this book, one of the things that characterizes Silicon Valley generally is there is to a great degree, you have to suspend the normal rules of business.
Totally.
You have to suspend disbelief a bit. And it was simply obvious to Peter that like the markets were not done with their bloodletting at the end of March of 2000. Like they have this huge amount of money. He has a hedge fund.
Yep.
Isn't it just like obvious that like we could actually extend our runway and make a lot more money by shorting the markets? Like, you know, and he presents this to the board. Like one of my favorite people I interviewed was this board member. And he said, he's like, this was just like, there's like so many things wrong with this. and he had this great line. He said, Peter, if you're right, and you might be right, like the company will do well. But if you're wrong, we could end up in a lot of trouble because
totally.
We have a fiduciary duty
yeah.
to the people who are our investors. And one of those duties is like not investing in public markets
right.
with the money we've been given. Right,
right, right.
And so he's like, you might be farsighted and you might be a genius, but we can't do this. And Peter is so frustrated by this that he actually boycotts some subsequent board meetings in protest, right? Because as a corporate officer, he's also a member of the board. So he's just like, no, I'm not going to do that. That's like, I'm not going to go. They rejected my idea. Now, it turns out he's like stunningly right.
Totally.
Because the market does collapse. And my favorite part of the whole thing, honestly, like if I look back on the telling of it, is there was a board member who at the time of Elon is CEO.
Yep.
So Elon has to hand the mic, not a physical mic, but give the floor to Peter. And I think Elon realizes that this idea is not going to go over super well with
right.
the board. And so somebody, the way they described it, they said Elon kind of like shuffled and was like, okay, yeah, Peter has an idea he'd like to suggest. Like, it wasn't like this enthusiasm,
man.
Right? It wasn't like Elon was coming in and saying, yeah, like, here we go. Here's Peter's great idea. So they're like, yeah, Peter has something he would like to suggest to the group, right? And so then the suggestion is made. It is soundly rejected by the board.
Yep.
Or roundly rejected. Not so, it's rejected by the board. And Peter protests the next few meetings. Now, I find a lot that's like super interesting about this anecdote. And I think, but for me, one of the bigger things is just there were multiple moments where you saw what makes Silicon Valley, especially at that time, so remarkable, which is that it is a place where a 20-something is allowed to say that he's going to be the person who defeats Bank of America.
Right.
It's a place where like another 20-something can say, oh, Palm Pilot money beaming is like the future of money. Like the future of currency is going to be Palm Pilot money beaming. And it's a place where I think it was late 20s or early 30s where Peter Thiel can say, well, just give the money to my hedge fund. We'll short the market. We'll all
right,
be rich.
Right. Right.
like it's this place where you are allowed to say the things that would be verboten in other contexts. And they're not just like, with the exception of Peter's idea, that a lot of these ideas like have so much excitement and enthusiasm behind it to the point that people will back you with millions of dollars. I don't think there's been a time in human history where things like this have been true, right?
No,
which is what makes this whole ecosystem so fascinating to somebody like me, who's still, again, a bit of an outsider. But that was one additional kind of like evidentiary point in favor of this very fine line between genius and madness that exists in Silicon Valley.
It's a really great point, and I think it does put what you were talking about before with Bell Labs and with some of these other sort of constellations of talent that you have over history. And you can go back hundreds, thousands of years and find other sort of similar collections. But it is, I guess, sort of unusual in human history to have that collection of talent combined with an environment where it's just like, you do you. Like, here's money, go do your thing. Like, those two things in combination maybe has never happened before. So it is a pretty remarkable story. Before I let you go, two things, if we sort of jump to the present, that I wanted to get your take on real quick. One is just PayPal. So, I mean, I know you talked to all of the principals involved. I think Elon in particular sounds like is still someone who has opinions about PayPal and what they're doing. But, I mean, obviously they went through an IPO, which you cover in the book. They went through an acquisition by PayPal, or by eBay rather, that you go through in the book. They're subsequently spun back out of eBay. I think Carl Icahn makes a little appearance at that point in the story. And then, you know, the history for PayPal, and this is more where my sort of modern understanding of the company comes in, they have a really successful run, right? I mean, the stock goes up tremendously. They expand internationally. They become very acquisitive in terms of buying up other companies. Ironically, they end up owning a company called Venmo that was sort of doing a version of what they had been talking about with beaming money and splitting checks and stuff. And so there's all of these things that they do. I think it kind of crests during the pandemic when everyone is convinced that, you know, PayPal is going to be the future of e-commerce and just sort of financial services generally. Dan Schulman is at the helm at that point. He has kind of a vision, which is strikingly similar to me, actually, to Elon Musk's original vision of, like, we're going to be a super app for finances and everything is going to flow through what PayPal can do. It's this really, like, ambitious vision. And then we kind of come out of that. And you know, I can tell you the sentiment on PayPal in fintech has really kind of turned the last, like, year or so. And I think a little bit has to do with the new CEO, Alex Chriss, who's come in. They have kind of a pared back set of ambitions. But I'm curious, you probably get asked this all the time, given the book, what's your sort of take on where PayPal has ended up relative to kind of the vision and that initial kind of collision of talent that drove it?
It's a good question. And my answer might be, like, unfortunately, a bit unsatisfying, which is I don't know. And the reason that I don't know is because, you know, I took great pains to make sure that the things that I was writing about of the PayPal of 1998 to 2003 were kind of backed by paper records or interviews. And, you know, like a good example is, like, I had no reason to communicate with Dan Schulman while I was writing the book. Like, right. there was no real value there. My own impressions, and this is what I'll say, which is hopefully interesting.
Yeah.
You know, there's always this kind of nostalgia for the good old days. And, like, we tend to think that, like, history is better than it actually was. And I would say that the creators and founders of PayPal, the PayPal they remember is the PayPal they created between the years 1998 and 2003. It's a startup. There is more of a devil-may-care attitude. There's more of a focus on winning. They're less assured that they're going to be successful. They're not a publicly traded company until 2002. And so there's this kind of, like, why can't they just, and then insert whatever the thing is, right? And so I would say that I heard that criticism from a few people, like, why can't they just, you know, get paper checks? Why can't they just do this and this and this? But at the same time, I think that, like, we've got to remember that this is now an entity that, like, is over 20 years old.
Yeah.
Like, it has a specific place within the market, right? It would be like asking why one of the legacy automakers did not become Tesla.
Right.
And it is because, actually, like, the nature of business at a startup is different than the nature of business at a company that employs thousands of people around the world and does transactions in 180 countries, right? And so there is a kind of, on Elon's side, like, a little bit of, like, oh, if only the dream had been fulfilled, if only PayPal had been the world's largest company. And I think he's trying to revive some of those ambitions with X and with his acquisition of Twitter. And I think that, but I think that the idea of, like, oh, why can't this PayPal be, you know, moving as quickly and breaking as many things as the PayPal of yore? I'm not in a position to judge, but to me, that judgment's a little harsh because we are talking about a fundamentally different company.
Yeah.
And it is subject to many, many more rules and regs than PayPal was at its creation. And it employs many, many, many more people. So it is a supertanker, and shifting a supertanker is super hard, right? And like ask anyone that's written about turnarounds in any industry, and they're notoriously difficult. But the other piece of it is I have sort of cop to my ignorance, which is because I don't cover, you know, the ticker PYPL every day, I'm not as familiar with the product development. I find historical irony in the fact that, as you mentioned, they acquired Venmo and Venmo kind of fulfilled the money beaming ambitions in a certain way.
Yeah.
And to me, the thing that I can kind of end on, or, like, end this thought on, is it's a remarkable thing that this brand and this company is still around 20 plus years later, and that so much of the mechanism of what makes PayPal work from a UX perspective honestly looks so similar to what was originally created, down to the color choices and down to the logos. Yes. I mean, there's so much that is true of modern PayPal that was devised by this group of people between the years 1998 and 2003. It blew my mind to think about it when I was like, wow, you know, they capitalized the second P in PayPal today. Why did that happen? It happened because when someone wrote it on the PowerPoint presentation, that appealed to the people doing the naming and the design.
Yeah.
And, like, it's literally where it traces back from. And so that's probably about where I have my limits of being able to comment on contemporary PayPal.
No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I would kind of equate it to, I mean, you draw a really good analogy to the automakers, right? And it's like, if you think about the lifespan of really successful companies that last for 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, whatever, like PayPal is still very much in its like teenage years in that context, right? And so I do notice this thing with PayPal where they were like a particularly rebellious teenager when they were younger. Like they were an especially sort of problematic and wild and talented teenager that like, wow, people told a lot of stories about them. And now they're going through this transition into kind of adulthood. And it's still, I think, somewhat early for them relative to like a Visa or a Bank of America or someone like that. But you can kind of sense this dissonance with the company of even folks who are still there, they kind of are familiar with the lineage, like they can feel that sort of spirit still kind of reaching back from the past. But the company, as you say, is in a very different place. They have a very different set of incentives, and it's just sort of the natural maturation of how these things happen. Real quickly, you mentioned Elon Musk and X and Twitter. Is he ever going to give up this vision of trying to make whatever the thing is? I mean, he got the X domain name back, right? Like, I mean,
yep.
He is seemingly convinced that X is the perfect name for a company. It's the perfect URL on the internet. And it needs to be the centerpiece of all of financial services. And like, that's a dream that won't die.
Well, look, and there's a line that Peter said to me, and I think others have said it too, but just never bet against Elon. Like totally. He has a way of pulling these rabbits out of hats. What I would say is two observations. One is, you know, his critique of financial services at that time, which was that it was sort of packed with fees that shouldn't have been paid, that there was no effort to actually drive those down. There was no actual effort to drive efficiencies. You know, there have been many startups that have cropped up in the intervening two decades that have actually like taken advantage of that.
That's the industry I work in. Yeah. I mean, that's like, yeah. It's funny you say that actually, because in the book you had the text that they had on x.com when they were signing up users, right? It was just like, put your email in and when we're ready to go, we'll add you to the list. I copied that text verbatim. I stripped out X's name and I put it on Twitter and I was like, hey, guess which fintech startup wrote this? And it was so funny because no one, without cheating, no one got it. And they were guessing companies
funny.
That are like 10, 15, 20 years newer than PayPal, like modern companies. They're like, oh, was it, you know, name this neobank or whatever? Because it sounds exactly like how they talk about the problem.
Yep. And I would say take one other step further into a slightly different field, not it's tangent. You know, when Confinity first launched, it described its PayPal product as the new world currency. Like, where have we heard that? You know, there's this whole language in the crypto space that is very, very consonant with the stuff that the folks at PayPal were trying to build early on. The idea of this industry, like that is conservative in nature. Well, why can't they do this better? Why can't they do this cheaper? So I think like in some ways, Elon's thesis was right. He was just 20 years early, or was let's say 10 years early.
Yeah.
Because you have, for example, like I only know this because I'm a customer, like Fidelity has no cost index funds at this point where you're paying no fees, mm-hmm. right? And so the idea of driving fees down and driving efficiencies up is not breathtakingly new, but there have been a bunch of efforts made to do that. I would say that one of the things that is central to his success is that Elon reasons from first principles,
right?
And so one of the ideas that is at the heart of what his conception of X.com was and what became PayPal is there is still friction involved in having one company manage one part of your financial life and another company manage another part of your financial life. And if you can bring those all under the same ecosystem, you can reduce friction and you can reduce fees. And to date, there is still not the kind of one place to rule them all. Now, there are a bunch of reasons why that's probably a good thing, right? Like, but to his mind, it is the case that like he could use X and create X mortgage, X bank, X checking, X savings. Whether he is successful or not, I don't know. I can't predict. But I think that the thesis has more to do with information theory and with science than people will appreciate. And that's sort of like, let me explain that just a bit, which is in the course of my interview with him, one of the things he said is, there was a kind of stunning quote and it was really memorable. He said, money is just an information system.
Right.
He said, people think money has value, but it's really just the system we created. Money is an information system. It's the system we created so that you, Alex, and I, Jimmy, don't have to barter, right? I don't have to like trade you my headphones for your microphone. We have money. We have this thing, this information system. He said, if you think about money from first principles, That is a different way to think about then the configuration of everything that's around money, including digital financial services. Because then it really doesn't make sense that your like insurance provider is different than the person who does your mortgage, is different than the person who does your banking. Like in a universe in which money is just an information system, and where money at this point, not in human history, for many people around the world, is just bits in a database, like you really are like kind of paying for nothing. Like if you're paying a fee, like for currency conversion, for example, you're kind of just getting fleeced. Like it's like, oh, like that's, and by the way, most of us are only too happy to have that because the things that come with that payment are security, trust, convenience, whatever, right?
Right.
To Elon's mind, like if money is just an information system, money ought to be more efficient.
Yep.
And it ought not to take several days to do transfers, and it ought not to cost you money to do X, Y, and Z. And so I think the ambition is still there. I think he's trying to use X slowly but surely to make that mission come to life. Whether it reconciles with a social network, I don't know. But like the ambition is still there and many of the problems still are too.
It's absolutely true. I mean, everything that you just described is the sort of macro thesis that continues to drive fintech forward. And, you know, we don't, again, like he was an intern at Scotiabank in the 90s. Like that blows my mind. But like, you know, he's a fintech guy first and foremost, which is just such a funny framing for one of the most famous entrepreneurs and just this constellation of talent that you covered in the book. Truly, for folks who haven't read it, you can tell I'm obsessed with it and I've read it multiple times. Can't recommend it enough. And actually, as one final treat before I let Jimmy go, Jimmy has very graciously agreed to sign a small number of books for us so that I can give those away to listeners of the podcast. So if you have made it all the way through this fascinating conversation and you would like a signed copy of this book, which trust me, you do, tweet at me or I guess zeet at me, hit me up on LinkedIn, you know, send me a message via email. And first folks who reach out, please try to mention something about PayPal or something that fascinates you about this company. It's truly an interesting story and we'll get you a copy of that book. Jimmy, thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for coming on the podcast. This was my favorite thing I've done in a long time. I really appreciate it.
Alex, thank you. I mean, it really says something about, you know, I just really appreciate as an author, like how carefully you read the book. Because what I can tell you is like underneath every one of those anecdotes, just given the personalities involved, is like days, more than day, months of work and fact checking and research and making sure I'm not going to get sued to oblivion and all the other things, right? And so I just really like it warms my heart when somebody who knows about the space really enjoys the book. And hopefully, like, and that my bar for it was that a reader like you would learn new things. Because I'm operating from the assumption that because you're in this field, you've probably, you know, you've probably read like 0 to 1, or you've read the Elon bio by Ashley Vance or others, right? And so to my mind, I was like trying to hit a bar of like, no, I'm going to explain random deposit, and I'm going to explain the CAPTCHA, and I'm going to explain early virality and all of these things that we take for granted. So just, I was really appreciate how carefully you read the book. And I hope readers or your listeners who hopefully become readers get as much out of it as you did.
I'm sure they will. It really was. It's an incredible accomplishment. And I appreciate you coming on and walking us through some of these stories. This is great. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FinTech Takes. Stay up to date with emerging companies and the latest FinTech trends by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love FinTech Takes, please tell a friend.